The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act again. Supporters are happy, but some are also ready to look forward.
Hopefully we can focus now on how do we make this work better? How do we improve on some of the progress that's been made?
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, ASU unveils a plan for a massive development on its Tempe campus. Medicine gets very personal, and some insurance companies are saving their money for a rainy day.
And is Arizona losing out on federal money to deal with summer temperatures?
Even though with the heat that we have and more people dying from heat than cold, we as a state receive the fewest amount of these dollars per capita in the nation.
Plus, what's behind Arizona's tourism numbers? And we go to school.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. This morning, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a provision of the Affordable Care Act. In a 6-3 ruling, the justices said the federal tax credits allowed by the law are available to all eligible residents, not just those in states that created their own exchanges. Arizona and 33 other states did not set up an exchange and use the federal one. Dan Dirksen, director of the Center for Rural Health at the U of A, is happy with the decision.
The biggest issue, the most important issue, is that millions of people didn't lose their health insurance as a result of an adverse decision on this. So that, first and foremost, this would have affected so many people in such a negative way that I was very pleased that the Supreme Court upheld with a 6-3 decision that the subsidies to help make health insurance affordable were upheld. So that's a great outcome, and hopefully we can focus now on how do we make this work better, how do we improve on some of the progress that's been made.
Do you think that there will be an increased push now that this case has been resolved to sign up more Arizonans during the next open enrollment period?
Yes, I do. I think that we'll see in round three. You know, we just completed round two in January, and at that time, through March, the analysis showed that about 205,000 Arizonans had either renewed their coverage to the Arizona marketplace or selected a plan. But the numerator and denominator of that equation is 205,000 did so, but there's 628,000 who were eligible. So we only had a participation rate of 33%. If you're an insurance company, that means there's still 400,000 potential customers out there who could receive coverage through the Arizona marketplace. So I think we'll see the insurers. We have a very competitive marketplace in Arizona. So we have a lot of competition, but 2 out of 3 Arizonans that could get coverage either didn't know about it or didn't take advantage of it. So I think when round three starts in November, I think we'll be getting a tremendous amount of interest, and we'll be able to push that participation rate from 1 out of 3 to at least 50% or more participation rate.
Do you think that there's enough variety and diversity of plans available, including ones for folks who maybe don't have a ton of money to spend on healthcare? I mean, do you think that Arizona needs a sort of a bigger universe of available health plans that people can buy?
I actually think it's the other end of the spectrum for Arizona. For many, especially those who don't speak English as their first language, it's a bewildering array of choices. And I think what we haven't done well is for those populations that had very low participation rates, we need to really make sure that people understand their choices, really assist them and target that assistance so that people can make educated, informed decisions about it in using language and terms that people understand.
Dan Dirksen is the director of the Center for Rural Health at the University of Arizona. Dan, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
There are, of course, many who disagreed with the High Court's decision. One of those is Naomi Lopez-Bauman, Director of Healthcare Policy for the Goldwater Institute.
Well, it was a little bit disappointing because we do know that we still have a lot of work to do on healthcare reform to deliver the still unmet promises of the Affordable Care Act, those being healthcare access and affordability. So it's really up to congressional lawmakers on both sides of the aisle to continue to to pass meaningful healthcare reform in ways that respect taxpayers, provide for the truly needy, and address healthcare costs.
Observers have gotten bogged down into the politics of this, of the House trying to overturn and whatnot. Are there more productive ways going forward to, I don't want to say chip away at it, but modify the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, for all of the Affordable Care Act's shortcomings, one really important element of that law is that individuals who could not access health insurance through their employer did receive some kind of benefit that you and I, who have, you know, employer-sponsored health insurance, do receive. And so that was one benefit of the law. But I do think that whenever you take a look at some of the other ways that the Affordable Care Act is making health insurance far more expensive for many, and the access issue is something that still needs to be addressed. I think there's support on both sides of the aisle, I think, to go back and look at what can be done, specifically things that could allow Arizona to regain control over their health insurance market and offer a much wider array of health insurance products for consumers. Many of those would have lower price options, and of course they would have fewer benefits than are currently offered, but some of these approaches would better meet Arizona families' needs and preferences. We need more flexibility and not more Washington knows best edicts when it comes to understanding and addressing Arizona families' and individuals' health care needs. One potential avenue for reform could be something called the State Innovation Waiver. And that was actually included in the Affordable Care Act under Section 1332. While we need to do a lot more, you know, examination of what exactly this waiver would entail and what the options would be for the state, it could allow the state to exempt itself from some of the most arduous provisions of the law, those being some of the insurance regulations that are really driving up the cost of health insurance premiums.
Is there risk involved with Arizona trying to come up with something, obviously not an exchange, but something that involves innovation where the state might have to pay for something itself? Is there a concern that federal funds, you know, we really still want to lean on those federal funds and not act too quickly in another direction as well?
Well, I think that's going to be a really big issue that's going to play out over the next few months and then again in 2017. There is a lot of political support for giving states the option to opt out of the Affordable Care Act in some way, shape, or form, probably not entirely, but at least giving states more control. So the question is going to be, what does that support from the federal government entail? And, you know, to my way of thinking, if the state was actually allowed to get out of the very expensive, you know, the provisions that are costing consumers a lot more money in many cases, and really offer a better and broader array of health insurance products, that it would be worth foregoing subsidies.
Naomi Lopez-Bauman is Director of Healthcare Policy for the Goldwater Institute. Naomi, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Last night, a crowd gathered at Grant Park in downtown Phoenix to discuss the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. One topic was what should happen to Sheriff Joe Arpaio since he admitted to violating the judge's orders in a racial profiling case. Many community members said they wanted Arpaio out of office and sent to jail. Joining me now with the latest on the sheriff's legal troubles is KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Steve.
So, Jude, the forum was convened by the court-appointed advisory board in this case?
Right. The board was created by Judge Snow after he ruled the sheriff's office racially profiled. That was 2 years ago. The advisory board is supposed to pass community feedback on to the judge's independent monitor. And the feedback last night was overwhelming. People there want Arpaio out of office and want punishment. The fact that the sheriff violated Judge Snow's order to stop enforcing federal immigration law, that he ignored that order, kept detaining immigrants and turning them over to federal agents for deportation, that hit really close to the crowd last night. A lot of people there were Latino immigrants. They spoke of the way Arpaio has caused family separations and trauma in the community. They want to see him criminally punished for that.
And as we've discussed before, the sheriff's in the middle of civil contempt of court proceedings for those violations. Judge Murray Snow has threatened he might refer the case to a federal prosecutor for criminal charges, but there have been delays in the contempt case. Where do things stand right now?
Well, originally this week and last week were supposed to be dates for the contempt hearing, but all that got put on hold when Arpaio asked Judge Snow to recuse himself. As we've talked about before, Arpaio feels Snow introduced a conflict of interest when he directly questioned Arpaio about investigating him and his family. At this point, all the briefs on the recusal issue are in. The ball is in Snow's court at this point to rule. One thing is, if he does decide to stay on the case, many people expect the sheriff will appeal. And if he does step down, it will probably take another judge a while to get caught up.
So the contempt issue not likely to be settled soon?
No, I mean, maybe the fall? Keep in mind, adding to this already complicated calendar situation is that a second major case against Sheriff Arpaio is heating up. That's the Department of Justice's civil rights lawsuit against the sheriff. We found out recently it will go to trial on August 10th for 3 weeks, unless both sides reach a settlement before then. And the sheriff has the same lawyers defending him in both of these cases, so we can expect them to be tied up in August.
And can you briefly remind us what the DOJ case is about?
The key points for the trial portion are whether Arpaio and his staff illegally retaliated against their critics with baseless lawsuits and criminal charges, and whether the sheriff's office discriminated against non-English-speaking inmates in the jails.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block with the latest on the MCSO and Sheriff Arpaio. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
A report this week from the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU found this year's Super Bowl, played in Glendale, had an economic impact of nearly $720 million for the Valley. Also this week, Arizona tourism officials reported 40 million visitors to the state last year generated almost $21 billion in spending. Both numbers were higher than in 2013. To get a sense of tourism's impact on the state and its economy, we turn to Christine Vogt, director of the Center for Sustainable Tourism at ASU.
I think across all 50 states, you're probably going to see higher numbers. I mean, we're coming off of a consumer year when spending was higher and people had more discretionary funds to take vacations.
So this might not just be an Arizona thing.
Correct. And I came from Michigan, and we have also been projecting over the last year or two that we were going to be finally coming out of this recession, and that people would be back out traveling, both domestic as well as international tourists.
How much of the increase in the dollar number can you attribute to inflation, the fact that just things are more expensive now than they were maybe 5 or 7 years ago?
I actually asked Office of Tourism about whether these numbers have been adjusted for inflation by the consultant or the economist that put the numbers together, and I guess they are unadjusted. So there probably is a little bit of increase in prices that are attributed to the increase in the overall visitor spending. I mean, inflation's been running around 1% or so. Hotels are reporting higher room prices, but we've also seen gas decline over the last couple of years, although if you look at gas sort of now to last year, it's about the same. So, and food prices have been impacted a little bit also with the increased cost of fuel. So there are a few aspects of traveler spending that have probably been more subjected to inflation. Sometimes tourists sort of offset by looking online for some cheaper prices to make sure that they can hit their travel budget.
Does that make it harder to compare year to year when you're looking at numbers like that, when inflation isn't necessarily accounted for in the final number?
I guess when it changes and is very volatile, I think those are the hard conditions in which to interpret these numbers. But if inflation's been about the same over the last few years, then a comparison of the 2014 statistics to the 2013, inflation may not be as much of a player.
Do you think that inflation was a player in the Super Bowl numbers that were also released this week, $720 million economic impact this year versus $500 million in 2008?
There probably was an increase in prices, particularly in the Phoenix area, that can be attributed to some higher spending numbers by tourists. Hotels generally charge their highest prices during those time periods. Just the overall demand for more than sort of the market can supply is going to increase some prices, yes.
Tourism is obviously a very big and important industry in Arizona, but I'm curious if you think that this state might be too reliant on tourism. I mean, is it too big of an industry, given that it can change pretty dramatically given other economic conditions?
It can. I think that Arizona has always had tourism and hosting of visitors as part of their economy. It's a unique landscape. Obviously, the weather is attractive. Tourism can be attributed to much of the home sales here, whether it's retirees, second home. So I'm not sure I'm agreeing that it might get too big and we may need to sort of bring it down. I think Phoenix is definitely the dominant player in the economic numbers that were released. I think there's a lot of opportunity to distribute visitors throughout the state and maybe move some of this economic impact to the rural communities and some of the outlying counties in the state.
Christine Vogt is director of the Center for Sustainable Tourism at ASU. Christine, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Still to come, when you know what your medical future may hold, how do you decide what to do next?
I'd never really had any kind of surgery before, but I wasn't really scared of it. I'm more scared of cancer, and I saw my mom really suffer a lot.
Two sisters, two very different choices. That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Checking Valley traffic at this hour. Not much going on. There is an accident, though, on the 303 northbound at Glendale. As far as weather is concerned, look for partly cloudy skies tonight with overnight lows not cooling off too much in the upper 80s. Partly to mostly sunny for tomorrow with a high of 110. And then this weekend, chance for monsoon rain arrives, only a 10 to 20%, but there could be some blowing dust. Currently, relative humidity is at 15%, mostly clear skies, 107 degrees at 220.
KJZZ is supported by Home Instead Senior Care, serving the Valley since 1997 as a source of non-medical in-home services for seniors, from scheduled personal care to continuous Alzheimer's care. Info at homeinstead.com.
Summers in the Valley are always extremely hot, but the past week or so has seen record and near-record high temperatures, and that makes it even more vital to have the ability to cool off in your home or apartment. But what if you can't pay your electric bill? Susan Bitter-Smith is chair of the Arizona Corporation Commission.
All the major utility companies in Arizona do have customer service programs and low-income programs that obviously are available depending upon income.
Is this something that has come up as an issue that there are simply people who have a hard time affording it, and yet really without some form of cooling here, it's really difficult to survive? I mean, is that something that the commission is focused on? Have you actually had issues come up where people have complained about their particular utility not supporting them?
We have not had complaints about not having affordable services because, quite frankly, there are a number of programs in place that people are utilizing today. Every year, the commission has a summer preparedness overview that happens in a workshop setting where all the commissioners sit at every utility comes in and makes a presentation on what services are there for the normal customers and what energy challenges might be apparent, because obviously we know in some other states there have been rolling blackout issues. We want to make sure that those are not things that will happen in Arizona. And then there's a presentation again on programs that are available for lower income households and folks that are having potentially challenges that maybe are one-time instances.
Arizona Corporation Commission Chair Susan Bitter-Smith. There are groups around the Valley that try to help low-income residents through these warmer months. Bill Epps is Executive Director of the Tempe Community Action Agency. Bill, does the general need increase during the summer, and does the role of your group change?
It does in a couple of different ways. First, the amount of money that we have to distribute throughout the 12-month fiscal year, which begins July 1 for utility assistance. We plan to spend 50 to 60% of that in the first 4 months of the fiscal year, so roughly July through October, because that's candidly when the need is. Mm-hmm. And so we see our activity really jump in these first 4 months, not only for utility assistance, but also we are a hydration station for the area. And we also run a food pantry, and so we provide a great amount of water to people there. So the activity level for us, at least in that part of our business, is highest this time of year.
A lot of money goes toward eastern states as it relates to protecting them from the cold, allowing them to get more heat, et cetera. Places like Arizona or other western states where it gets warmer, there's not an even distribution to protect people from the heat as there is from the cold. Have you found that to be the case?
That is the case. And it's ironic because more people die from heat-related illnesses than from the cold. So to your point, the top eight states receiving these dollars on a per capita basis are the six New England states, North Dakota, and Minnesota. Arizona is 50th. Even though with the heat that we have and more people dying from heat than cold, we as a state receive the fewest amount of these dollars per capita in the nation.
Utilities in the state have various programs to assist people who have financial problems, may not be able to pay their bills, et cetera. Are there restrictions in place that would keep people from being thrown out, let's say, or are there programs for these utilities? Are they actually effective in terms of making sure that people are not either put in major debt or something terrible happens to them in the midst of this hot weather?
For Salt River Project, for example, put out a note a couple of weeks ago and that they said during the emergency heat wave, they would not shut off anybody's power. So they put that information out to the agencies that distribute these funds several days before the actual heat wave came about. So I don't know if that's something that is common amongst utility companies, but I do think SRP deserves credit for being willing to do that and do that proactively. Usually the amount of rental assistance that we will give a household, the average is about $500. So that gives you an idea as to the amount that people become in arrears before they come to get the assistance from us.
Bill Epps is Executive Director of the Tempe Community Action Agency.
This time of year, long parades of tourists drive through the Hopi and Navajo nations, taking pictures of the painted desert, red sandstone buttes, and desert wildflowers. What they often don't see behind the rocks, illegal dump sites. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales has the story.
On the western edge of the Navajo Nation in Tuba City, there's a popular scenic spot called Castle Rock. As you approach, a large hand-painted sign reads, "Please, no dumping." Drive a quarter mile toward the butte, and alongside the road you'll see a soggy gray couch and a scattered half-burned pile of trash. Tyler Tawahungva jokes that he'd like to recreate the iconic 1970s public service announcement, the one where Iron Eyes Cody sheds a tear over pollution.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country. And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
Saw all the litter in the lands wherever he was in the cities and stuff. So I was thinking this would be a perfect backdrop to do that kind of spoof. You know, do a tear in my eye sort of.
Ironically, Iron Eyes Cody was used as a symbol of love for the land. Yet now the problem in Indian country is that it's Native Americans doing the polluting. Tawahungva wants to change that.
Traditionally, we have been, you know, recyclers. We use everything. You know, from our hunting, whatever we gathered, everything was used. Unfortunately, you know, westernization or whatever you want to call it, we've gotten a little bit away from that.
Tawahungva has made it his mission to bring recycling back. And the problem he's addressing is huge. The Navajo and Hopi tribes cover an area the size of Ireland. Combined, they produce an estimated 300 million pounds of trash a year. And today, there are few places to dump trash legally. In 1979, the federal government tightened landfill regulations to do things like protect groundwater and prevent fires. The Navajo Nation was unable to comply with the new policy, so...
So that was my job, was to make sure that we close these landfills, 10 landfills, on the Navajo Nation.
James Benelli runs the Solid Waste Management Program for the Navajo Nation. Now the Navajo and Hopi tribes pay to have their trash brought to transfer stations, where it's hauled several miles away to landfills on the outskirts of the reservations. Many who live on dirt roads don't have any trash service, so some people just dump it in ditches. Benelli and his crew have cleaned up more than 150 of these illegal dump sites in the last few years, but he's counted at least 300 that remain, and it costs money.
For now, the picture kind of looks bleak as far as cleaning up the rest of the illegal dump sites.
Recycler Tyler Tawahungva says if more people recycled, there would be less trash to dump. A year and a half ago, Tawahungva quit his job as a substance abuse counselor when he realized he could make money recycling. He makes his rounds each day to a hotel, a grocery store, and a hospital to pick up as much recycling as he can stuff in the back of his minivan. he's made agreements with each business to set aside recyclables for him. Sometimes the bins start to overflow before he can get to them.
When they start overflowing, I get calls. They'll say, well, we'll just throw it in the trash. The worst five words of a recycler.
One of his many stops is the transfer station where people are supposed to throw their trash and recyclables.
This is the recycle bin. As you can see, it's paper, cardboard. They throw plastic.
Once he's accumulated enough cardboard, metal, and plastic in his backyard, Tawahungva rents a large truck and hauls the recyclables down to Phoenix, a total of 350 miles. There he gets $70 for each ton of cardboard. The price recently dropped, so with the cost of gas eating away at his profits, lately he's barely broke even. Still, it's worth it.
I don't think I could sleep at night if I knew it was all going to trash.
Tawahungva dreams of someday operating a regional recycling outfit on the reservation that generates substantial revenue. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
An analysis by Consumer Reports shows that many nonprofit health insurers across the country have stockpiled enormous amounts of money in case of unexpected events. That's not surprising or unreasonable, but some critics wonder whether the surpluses could be used to cut premiums or make other changes. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Arizona, for example, has set aside $1.03 billion. Bruce McPherson, president of the Alliance for Advancing Nonprofit Healthcare, explains what the savings are for.
When they're trying to set premiums for the future, they're guesstimating what future healthcare costs are going to be. They're guesstimating what level of unhealthiness, if you will, the subscribers that they enroll will be compared to the average. They want to set aside a certain amount of reserves for new insurance products. All of these estimates are just that. They're estimates that go into deciding what's a reasonable reserve level. Another way to look at it is, for instance, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Arizona, which is a nonprofit. It has a board of directors, and that board is basically a fiduciary for all of the resources of that plan in serving their community. And they have healthcare providers, they have employers and individual subscribers, they have a state insurance commissioner. So what they're trying to do in establishing their reserve levels is trying to balance the needs and desires of all those different constituencies.
But what about using the money to lower premiums, for example? Could that be done?
If you're a healthcare consumer or an employer, you would like to see lower premiums than what they are today. So you might want to look at those reserves and say, well, can't we take some of those reserves and lower the premiums? Then you've got health care providers who would want to say, well, I would like a chunk of those reserves in the form of higher provider payment rates.
Mm-hmm. We've heard about nonprofits and for-profits that since the Great Recession, there's been nervousness about the unknown, about what's to come. But is that a good enough reason to hold on to so much money?
There obviously was, for instance, a scare about Ebola here not all that long ago. And if some disease like that were to, spread across a particular locale or state, much less the nation, that would obviously have dramatic impacts on the future outlays for, diagnosing that type of disease. It would be a catastrophic situation. There's no doubt about it. We've got terrorism out there, which could, have a dramatic impact in a particular locale for both the subscribers as well as the plan.
Bruce McPherson is president and CEO of the Alliance for Advancing Nonprofit Healthcare. Bruce, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
You are listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Thank you, Isabella. My name is Allison Richardson. I'm a parent of two children that attend Maria Reed Montessori.
Okay, so we're going to get these. And here's the jungle.
So this is just their work time. They have free movement of the classroom. A lot of what the guide does is she steps back and she tries to limit her interactions with the children and just let them explore.
We're gonna learn how to read. Okay, so these are the vowels. A, E, I. Would you like a peanut?
They actually asked the other day to pull up the weeds in the backyard because they thought that would be fun work. So the things that they do here are just life skills.
You can count on me like 1, 2, 3, I'll be there.
That's Allison Richardson in her kids' preschool class at Maria Reed Montessori School in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we should relearn our ABCs, send us a note, the show, at kjzz.org.
Still to come, hockey teams can officially start talking to free agents next week, but some are already sending a message to the Coyotes.
Don Maloney, our GM, has been told, you know, exclusively by every agent he's talked to, that this is going to, you know, cause issues with potential of players coming.
A conversation with the Coyotes co-owner is ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. On Valley Roadways, 303 northbound in the West Valley, an accident on the Glendale Avenue exit ramp. Also on the 202 eastbound, some pretty heavy slowing from about 40th Street into about the 51. Look for partly sunny skies across the valley for the rest of the day. Still looking for a high of 111. 106 is average for today. It'll be partly cloudy tonight. Overnight lows in the upper 80s. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 110. Slight chance of rain on Saturday with a high of 111. Right now in Phoenix with relative humidity of 15%, it's 107 degrees at 236.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo, where personalized conversations can help you reach your financial goals. Because an open dialogue can open doors, Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Obama says the Affordable Care Act is here to stay now that the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision, has upheld a key provision of the law.
This law is working exactly as it's supposed to. In many ways, this law is working better than we expected it to.
Obama said in the U.S., health care is not a privilege for a few, but a right for all. The justices rejected a challenge that would have halted tax credits for nearly 6.5 million lower-income Americans, credits that have helped them pay for health insurance under the law. Militants with the self-proclaimed Islamic State, or ISIS for short, have launched a counterattack in Syria after recent significant battlefield losses. NPR's Deborah Amos has more.
The attack began with a car bomb and a caravan of militants disguised in rebel uniforms shooting at anyone on the streets, according to a Kurdish spokesman. The counteroffensive comes after significant ISIS losses, says Syrian activist Assad al-Achi.
The explosion we saw in Kobani today was just a very strong message that ISIS can come back at any minute. And let's not assume that it's a done deal with ISIS being out.
But ISIS was driven out of a key supply route by the Kurdish militia that also drove deep into the militants' territory. Deborah Amos, NPR News in southern Turkey.
A choir singing at the first of the funerals for the 9 people killed last week in Charleston, South Carolina. 70-year-old Ethel Lance was remembered as a loving woman, a woman with an infectious smile. Grandson Brandon Risher says his grandmother may have been a victim of hate.
She could be a symbol for love.
President Obama travels to Charleston tomorrow to give the eulogy for the Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who was the pastor of the historic church where the shootings occurred. On Wall Street today, the Dow lost 75 points. The Nasdaq was down 10. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. In KJZZ News, in a 6-3 ruling this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the tax credits given to residents of states who did not create their own health exchange. Arizona and 33 other states used the federal exchange. Critics had argued the law was written to only allow the credits for enrollees under state-run exchanges. The High Court is expected to rule either tomorrow or Monday on the constitutionality of Arizona's method of drawing congressional district boundaries. As KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, the decision could also impact a handful of other states with similar systems.
The voter-approved Independent Redistricting Commission was created in 2000. The five-member panel is tasked with using census data to redesign the state's congressional districts. Attorneys representing the Republican majority in the state legislature have challenged the constitutionality of this panel, arguing that only elected bodies can have that responsibility. If the Supreme Court justices agree, redistricting authority would be shifted to the Arizona legislature. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Medical decisions are inherently personal ones and can be based on any number of factors. For Robin Radway of Tempe, seeing her mom pass away from breast cancer prompted her to have her own genetic testing done. It found the 47-year-old was at higher risk for breast cancer, so she took preventative action. She had surgery to remove her ovaries and then had a bilateral mastectomy, and she says it was an easy choice to make.
For me, I felt it was a no-brainer. I'd never really had any kind of surgery before, but I wasn't really scared of it. I'm more scared of cancer, and I saw my mom really suffer a lot.
Her testing looked at the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. The National Cancer Institute describes these genes as producing tumor suppressor proteins, which help repair damaged DNA. They also ensure the stability of a cell's genetic material. Robin's test showed a mutation in the BRCA2 gene, something that happens in about 1 in 400 people. But among Ashkenazi Jews, which includes Robin, that ratio is about 1 in 40. People who have a mutation in the BRCA2 gene have up to a 70% chance of getting breast cancer by age 70. There's also increased risks of ovarian cancer in women and prostate cancer in men. For Robin, thinking about her two kids played into her decision to have surgery.
You know, I want to live. I want to be here for my kids, for my grandkids. That's it. So I made the choice to be proactive.
Was it a tough decision? I mean, you're removing parts of your body. I mean, was that a tough decision to make?
No. For me, it wasn't a tough decision. And I had actually made my decision before I got the results of my test. I had decided if I was positive, that's what I wanted to do.
Robin's younger sister, though, made a completely different decision. 45-year-old Erica Radway, who lives in San Diego, has not had genetic testing. She focuses on staying healthy through diet and meditation.
Having as much information as possible is great. But this is what gives me peace of mind, you know, making the choices that I've made. And I think to me, that's the most important.
Erica also has thermal imaging every 6 months. She acknowledges it's not a widely accepted method of screening, but she's comfortable with it. But that's not to say she wouldn't seek other care if she ever had cancer.
I would look for definitely qualified medical professionals, but people with a more holistic approach and don't have a mindset that, you know, you either have to cut it out, poison it out, or burn it out, or you won't survive. I'm not comfortable with those things. I mean, I'm not saying I would never do them, but it wouldn't be my first choice.
And even though Erica's never been tested, she assumes her BRCA genes have mutations like her sister.
I think one, because of family history, and two, just to be the even more proactive, you know, than I would be. I think I like to err on the side of caution. I know for many people this doesn't sound like I'm taking precautions, but I think just so that I would do the maximum, what I feel comfortable with.
Both sisters use that same phrase, proactive, to describe their approaches, even though those approaches are very different. Arlie Colvin is familiar with this kind of decision-making. She's a cancer genetic counselor for Honor Health and worked with Robin Radway.
Usually people are coming to me either because they have cancer, and that cancer maybe occurred at a young age, or maybe they've been diagnosed with cancer multiple times. That, or they have a person doesn't have cancer, but they have a family history of cancer that is significant enough that they should be coming in. And sometimes people have both personal and family history of cancer.
When somebody gets the information that you're giving them, mm-hmm. how do you talk to them about what their next steps are and make right. sure that their reaction is proportional to the information that you've given them?
Right. So for some genes, like the BRCA1 and 2 genes, we know a lot. And we have sets of guidelines that are, reviewed by experts, and the whole field is following these. And so we are confident in saying, okay, these are the things that you should be doing. These are the surgeries potentially that we'd recommend. Or if you don't want to have surgery, you can do this increased screening. It gets more difficult when we have genes that we don't know anything about. We think it causes increased risk of certain cancers, but we don't have guidelines for people. And in those cases, you can be, more conservative and recommend more aggressive treatment. But in a lot of cases, we have to just do what we can do, but can't address it as well as things like BRCA1 and 2.
To me, this kind of raises the question. It's sort of a hypothetical that we hear a lot about, and it's along the same lines. Like, for example, if you knew when you were 30 that you were mm-hmm. at increased likelihood to have Alzheimer's when you were yeah. older, what would you do differently? Like, would you live your life differently? Would you do things differently? Right. Would you try to cram everything into the years that you thought you had? Do you find that patients have that question for you when you give mm-hmm. them this kind of information?
Yeah. The biggest thing I think people face is my patients who are women who have tested positive for a BRCA1 or 2 mutation who haven't had children yet. And yet now they're facing this ovarian cancer risk, and we want them to have their ovaries removed. So those women, we're introducing an urgency into their lives that is an uncomfortable sort of urgency. But it's one we can't avoid because ovarian cancer is very dangerous.
Do you think that the kind of genetic screening that we're talking about here is available enough to enough people?
So in most cases, we can get insurance to cover this testing. So I would say for those people out there who, are getting regular medical care, it's probably been offered to them. But there are a lot of folks, particularly living in rural areas or people who just don't go see their doctor, who aren't aware that these genes exist and aren't aware that genetic testing would be possible for them. So in that case, I would say it is underutilized. Yeah.
As scientists and researchers continue to look for ways to sort of make treatments more personalized and really target medications and other treatments to somebody's individual DNA or their own individual mm-hmm. situation, how do you think that what you do will evolve?
So I think the biggest thing we're doing right now is that if we know that a person, say ovarian cancer or pancreatic cancer or whatever it is due to a mutation that they inherited from a parent, there are some of those genes we have targeted therapies, and we can use that to then treat their cancer in a better way. And so we are involved in the testing process for that. And going forward, as we develop more and more therapies for these various genes, I would think we'd be more and more involved.
Arlie Colvin is a cancer genetic counselor for Honor Health. The National Hockey League draft starts tomorrow afternoon. The Coyotes have the 3rd overall pick and will be hosting a party at Gila River Arena. The team in Glendale will also be back in court on Monday in the case over the city's vote to cancel its lease agreement with the Coyotes. Team co-owner Anthony LeBlanc says this year's draft party will also serve as a rally.
I think it's more important in respect to us as the Coyotes, showing the fan base and our sponsors that we are committed to the market. We feel very strongly in the legal arguments we have in regards to the current situation with the city of Glendale, and we're committed to playing at Gila River Arena.
You've talked in the past about how sort of the ongoing drama with Glendale has hurt the team. And I'm wondering, now that we're in the off season, have you heard from free agents, from agents themselves who are saying, yeah, we're not so sure about getting involved in what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, the impact that we're seeing in a dramatic fashion is on two fronts, and you just hit the nail on the head on one of them, and that is, free agency. And it's interesting we're discussing that today, because today's the period in which the 1 week prior to free agency opening, which happens obviously a week from today on July 1st, we are allowed to start engaging with free agents and start having discussions. And Don Maloney, our GM, has been told you know, exclusively by every agent he's talked to, that this is going to, you know, cause issues with potential of players coming. And, you know, today I'm also meeting with the majority of our sponsors, and that's another group that is looking at this very closely, and it's causing them to take a pause in regards to, you know, at minimum, at long-term commitments, but even, you know, their commitments that they have with us currently, they're asking a lot of questions, and I have to say, I don't blame them. So it definitely has had a significant negative impact on us.
When you say you're committed to the market, could that include the possibility of moving the team back to downtown Phoenix?
You know, it's interesting, and I in particular thank you know, Mayor Stanton of downtown Phoenix and Councilmember Nowakowski, who have been very, you know, open publicly as well as privately in their endorsements of the Coyotes and indicating that they'd love to have discussions. I think that's premature at this point. You know, our only focus right now is here at Gila River Arena, but I do think it's quite telling, and again, we certainly respect and admire those local politicians for making those overtures. But at this point, I think it's premature.
Given everything that's gone on between the Coyotes and the city, why are you still so interested in staying in Glendale?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One's a, you know, it's a legal reason and a contractual reason. We have a contract that was signed, you know, less than 2 years ago that has 13 years remaining. So there's the moral and the legal side. But, you know, we have a great fan base. We think it's a great building, a great market. And, you know, we're definitely are committed and continue to be committed to the building. And look, you know, we as the owners, we continue to put millions of dollars every offseason into this building to make it a better fan experience. So this is our home, and we intend to keep it that way.
Do you think there will come a point at which fans will just say, enough of this? Like, we can't get invested in this because there's so much off-the-ice stuff going on.
Well, it's, you know, and I certainly understand fans doing that, and we definitely have. You know, I spoke about free agents and sponsors, but there's no question there's been some fans who have reached out to us who have said, guys, we love you, but we just can't go through this again. And it's an absolute shame, but I don't think that their actions are shameful. It's a shame that this is happening, and I completely understand where they're coming from. We don't feel that it's anywhere close to the uncertainty that was in place in the past when, you know, the NHL owned the franchise and was looking for ownership, which obviously we became the new owners 2 years ago. But we understand fans being frustrated, absolutely.
Anthony LeBlanc is the co-owner of the Arizona Coyotes. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. In Valley traffic, accidents I-17 northbound at Union Hills. There's also a collision I-10 eastbound at 7th Street, blocking the right lane. Next couple of days around the valley should be partly to mostly sunny, high temperatures between 109 and 111. Currently, relative humidity is at 15%. It is mostly clear and 107 degrees at 251.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Oncology, together with the U.S. Oncology Network, united to redefine cancer care, working collaboratively with patients' primary physicians to ensure the highest continuity of care. More at ArizonaOncology.com.
ASU has announced plans to develop 330 acres at the northeast end of its Tempe campus into an athletic facilities district. In addition to sports venues, the project will include office space and housing. Joining me to talk about this is Brian Kearney, Senior Development Manager with Catellus, which will be developing the project. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
So what's the goal here?
So the goal is really twofold. The initial objective of this athletic facilities district was to create a funding mechanism to allow for the renovation and construction of ASU athletic facilities and to help them be competitive within the Pac-12. The corollary goal that is made possible through this athletic facilities district is the opportunity to develop a world-class urban community for the greater Phoenix region. And that happens through the marriage of the funding mechanism for the athletic facilities being tied to real estate development in this district.
Is it common for universities to be taking on that kind of project? I mean, often it seems like cities would do that. Cities would work with a developer to come up with a plan for that sort of thing. Do other universities do this sort of thing?
You're right. It is certainly more common for cities. There are universities who have certainly undertaken redevelopment efforts. To our knowledge, this is the most entrepreneurial version of a program like this, and perhaps one of the largest versions of a program like this anywhere in the country.
So are there advantages for Tempe that ASU is taking this on as opposed to having the city do it?
Well, I think it's a win-win for the university and for the city, I think. All of the development will occur on university-owned land, and the financing mechanism specifically is that rather than property taxes being paid, as would normally be the case on privately owned land, in which a city may be involved, the developers will pay an in-lieu payment to ASU directly, which allows for the athletic facilities to be improved. Tempe, though, will receive all of the sales tax revenues, not just Tempe, but all the normal governmental agencies will receive all of their tax revenues that normally accrue from a redevelopment project like this. It's just that because it's on ASU-owned land, instead of property taxes, they'll be making the in-lieu payment to ASU.
So does that lessen the need then for ASU to rely on money from the state or from elsewhere to fund some of those projects?
Right. The beauty of this is that it allows for the athletic venues to be created without the need for taxpayer dollars or for tuition dollars to be dedicated to athletic facilities.
The state legislature authorized this kind of project a few years ago in 2010. How much of this development do you think is tied to the fact that state support for universities has been declining since 2010 and a little bit before that even?
Well, I think when ASU pursued the legislation that allowed for the establishment of these athletic facilities district, it was in recognition of the fact that state support is continually decreasing to the universities. And so they knew in order to be able to undertake this program, they were going to have to come up with a way that did not rely on public dollars.
What kinds of offices, what kinds of houses, who do you think will be living there, and what do you think will be populating this district once it's up?
Sure. We think it's going to be a world-class urban district, and so it's immediately adjacent to downtown, immediately adjacent to the campus and Tempe Town Lake and the airport. This is an opportunity that probably doesn't exist anywhere in the country. And so we really believe that this is going to be populated by mid and high-rise office buildings, by urban multifamily housing, by restaurant, retail, entertainment venues, hotels, all connected by strong pedestrian connections, bicycle connections, and the like. So this truly becomes a 24/7 walkable urban area.
This project is scheduled to be done in phases. Can you give us sort of a sense of what the timeline is, when you expect to start, what comes first, when the whole thing might be
done?
Sure,
sure. So from a timing perspective, we are very hopeful that we will begin formally marketing the first opportunity, the first phase, later this year, with construction to start by the end of 2016. And then it really depends on what the market demands from that point on. We see it as an overall a 20-year build-out. And when it's all said and done in 20 years, we're looking at just over 7 million square feet, again, of office, residential, hotel, retail, and the market will really dictate the timing of all of that.
Brian Kearney is Senior Development Manager with Catalyst, which will be developing the ASU Athletic Facilities District in Tempe. Brian, thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Elefante. Melodic to say and hard to explain, it's the name of a hand-built home 2 hours north of Phoenix. But think of it more of another dimension than a collection of dwellings. Its construction began more than 30 years ago as a painter's vision. He's now dead, but as KJZZ Stina Sieg found out, his creation lives on and evolves still.
People say you can't put Elefante into words. You just have to be there. So here I am, headed down an overgrown, winding path on a 4-acre lot, lined with fake grass, beaten down by decades of sun and feet.
Yeah, this place does look like a mini golf course of sorts, except for more strange.
Cole Lati is the unofficial Elefante ambassador, who takes me past amorphous sculptures and little shacks drenched in color, and to Ryan Mattson, Elefante's executive director for nearly 6 years. He's one of a half dozen caretakers in their 20s and 30s that live on site in a small village of vintage trailers.
We bring a little bit of youth culture to Elefante.
And Mattson says they're continuing what painter Michael Kahn and his wife Lita Levant Kahn started here on the lush banks of Oak Creek more than 30 years ago. It's beautiful and shaded and used to be mistaken as public land before its owners asked the couple to be caretakers.
It was just a handshake.
Which grew into a tangle of structures made by two people with no architectural experience or plans, just spontaneous creativity.
It sort of unfolded from their minds or extended off of their canvas.
Oh, wow.
Notice the temperature gets very comfortable in here.
Yeah.
Half of the building is buried underground.
We're walking under the vaulted ceiling of Hippodome, which Mattson thinks of as the heart of Elefante. I want to say it looks like something, a colorful ear canal maybe? But the domed, cathedral-like structure is a hodgepodge of so many things. Stacked rocks on the wall, a carpet mosaic on the floor, shiny mylar on the ceiling. Mattson says you couldn't get away with building something like this now.
Well, none of this was built to be resold. This was just built to live in. And it really became that extension of their heart.
That's a tradition Mattson and a core group of Elefante believers want to continue. They've spent the last few years raising awareness and money enough to purchase the land outright. Their mission? Explaining to the public why Elefante matters. Something co-creator Lita Levant Khan puts this way.
Because it's the creative pulse that's working there, and that never stops.
People would tell her the place inspired them to change all the colors in their own home or throw out their furniture and build new pieces themselves.
I mean, but everybody was so excited.
And that excitement can still be felt. Back at Elefante, darkness has fallen over a monthly celebration of Elefante lovers. Jerome resident Jessica Laurel Reese is sitting underneath a wonderland of trees, sparkling with tiny projected lights.
I mean, there's a different resonance here. There's like this, you know, hyper creative, really beautiful whimsy everywhere. And I think that that kind of follows you out of here.
And maybe nudges you to create something beautiful and strange and free of rules in your own life. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Elefante.
Be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. Will Friday be the day that the Supreme Court finally rules on Arizona's redistricting case? A lot of journalists certainly hope it will be. Also, who's selling? Those stories and much more are still to come tomorrow at 2 on the show.
And if you have some free time tonight, Mark, tonight at 7:30, we should try this. The National Comedy Theater in Mesa, Improv Uncensored. It's like the two of us on the radio without a delay button.
Yeah, that's scary.
Never know.
That is very scary. Speaking of comedy, you can check out Eric Griffin. He'll be doing stand-up tonight at Tempe Improv.
Scorpius Dance Theater presents Rock. That's tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday at 7:30 at Phoenix Theater.
The show is produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Anika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next at 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Hotel Del Coronado. Connecting happens the moment you choose to disconnect. With white sand beaches, San Diego weather, and personalized service and experiences. Reservations at hoteldel.com. Connect today.